Well, we're all back from the 4 hours of silence and the bonfire and the marvelous experience that we find in that setting. And from the very beginning, we decided to end Saturday night by asking a couple of our friends that are here to share with us for about 25 minutes each, no longer, anything they feel like talking about. There's no format. It is whatever is comfortable for them. And I'm very, very pleased that the two gentlemen that agreed to share, I'm just so happy they said yes. And so I'd like to introduce our first special guest from Los Angeles. Come on up, Jim.
Thank you, Sandy. I'm Jim from Los Angeles. It's funny. It's been great. This is just outstanding. That was yet another example. And thank you, Sandy, for putting this on every year. And thank you for everybody from Far Corners that takes, you know, goes out of their way and works so hard all year for this. This is just great to be with a bunch of men who do this work. This really, really have this need to get closer and try harder and really. You have a lot of good time. Have a good time doing it too. It's funny. I see the humor, like, because that silence was really great for me. Because again, I was reminded that, you know, I spent a lot of time talking in my head, as well as other people, and how I use words to separate myself from other people or to try to classify my experience as it's going on. And to get quiet like that is really. It's just like a, you know, it's a way of just. I mean, you've all experienced it. But what came to me this time was like how I can really pay attention. Like when I can really pay attention to what's going on around me. And I've heard somewhere this year something that I've been trying to put into practice, which is another definition of love is attention. You pay attention to something, you know, you really, that's a sign of love, and also helps me when I'm trying to, when I'm, you know, around people and I'm trying to get out of my own head, is to try to pay attention to what they're saying, which is not easy for me. Just to show you what a spiritual giant I am. I was, when I came here, I was very excited, of course, and when I came in, I saw that I was in the pool house, so I said to Chris, I said, you know, I'm going to say this one thing, and then I'm just going to let it go, but do you think that you could put me in one of those cabins like I was in last year? And, you know, we saw all the everything that went on with the logistics, and he's like, man, come on, look at this, really? And he didn't say it was much nicer than that, and I said, you know, I shouldn't have even asked, and that's classic. Thing with me and in my spiritual experience. I really think that I can control and enjoy my experience at the same time. And, of course, I give it afterwards because I love the pool house now. That's my new, I love that. It's air conditioned for one thing. That's a secret, but it's great. It's really, really comfortable in there. And yet it shows once again, like the reason why I want to do is because last year I had a great experience there. So I constantly find myself in my search to get closer to God, I'm constantly hampered by my idea of what God, my idea of what I think God or my experience should be. And I've never had a problem with the idea of a God per se. Like I've never been an atheist in my life. Both my parents were came from very highly rigid religious backgrounds that they both gave up when they came together, and my dad told me I could stop going to church because he didn't go to church. I could stop going to the church that they had kind of agreed on when I was seven, so I didn't go again. And I discovered, as you know, I discovered early on the joys of drinking and doing drugs. I thought I was 12, but I think I found some papers recently that were actually things, drawings and like little notes I wrote in sixth grade. So actually it was already then I was joking about drinking and stuff like that. So early on I found, you know, a sense of relief from my overly self-conscious state of mind that I never felt comfortable, which is, you know, something I think most of you are probably familiar with. And the thing that happened to me is when I was, I had this great good fortune experimentation with drugs. I had this incredibly powerful spiritual experience when I was 19 years old. Now, of course, you know, I think it was definitely a legitimate experience. No one else had the experience, and it was an awful experience. Because what happened is I got to experience every level of fear that I had in myself, all the way down past the fear of death. I didn't know that I was afraid of things below death. And then in the absence of that, I felt this great spirit move in. And I had this connection, which I really understood. I really felt a part of everything in a way that I didn't know was possible. And I felt enormous relief and understanding. And then about 2 months, for 2 months after that, I worked on a farm in Virginia. I was by myself. And I was doing a lot of reading, and I was reading about classic, like, mystical experiences. And I'm like, yeah, that's what happened to me. So when I returned back, I was in college at the time, when I returned back to college, I was a changed person. Yet within a month, because I had nothing to, I didn't have a community to share this with. I didn't know how to live with this. It was like I was given this, like, helicopter ride to the top of the mountain. I saw this bright light, and then I was put back down, and I was trying to integrate that into my life, and I just couldn't do it. And what I got out of that, my lack of experience, what I did with that is that I tried to, first of all, I felt like that God was transcendent. That there was a God, but he wasn't involved with what was going on down here. There was something that it was elsewhere. And the other thing that happened to me is that I wanted to have that feeling again. I wanted to go back to have that feeling, so I tried drugs, and that didn't work because it was just trying to do the same thing. I tried to have the exact same thing happen again, didn't work. And then I tried to follow different paths. Like I went and investigated the Quakers, some Tibetan Buddhists, and everything just didn't quite fit. It didn't make any sense to me. And so what happened is it isolated me. And that was my first experience with, like, spiritual pride, because at the same time that I felt like I'd had this experience, and it didn't make sense to anybody else, but I knew that it was true. But as time went on and I couldn't keep it alive, I started to feel more and more apart from it. And I remember for one case, I felt I was with these great guys, these guys, I never knew you worked in hospice. Good fortune to meet these Catholic priests that were involved in the Cornell Burn Center, and they were hospice priests there. For various reasons, I was finishing up my finals, and I was with these guys, and I'm like, oh, you know, I'm amazed by what you guys do. I mean, they were living this life where they were of total service, and I'm like, you know, I'm really interested in what you do, but I just don't. Do you guys really believe that? I mean, I can see it as a metaphor, but you really believe? They're like, yeah, we believe it. Like, and it just didn't, I couldn't do it. It was something I didn't know how to give it. I was trying to get this, all these things. I was trying to piece it all together, and it wasn't fitting. It was very fragmented. So the frustration that came to me from then, I came to my ego. This whole time I'm like trying to kill my ego. I see my ego, my self-centeredness, like all these things, but I'm still resisting it and fighting it, and therefore makes it stronger. And so what it did, it played a little trick on me. It said to me, that experience you had was not true. The actual experience of life, the real life experience, is that we're alone. We're not actually connected to one another. That's a lie of your biology. I mean, Sandy talked about, you know, you're in the middle, and every year as you turn around, you're obviously in the center of your universe. That was part of that. But what it really was is that we're mammals, right? We're social animals. And so this idea of love and this idea of being connected to everything is just a lie that comes from our biology. And what the real truth is beyond humans is that we're cold. It's the cold universe. The cold, hard truth is that we're alone. We're alone. There's no way around it. And this allowed me to do two things. It allowed me to have an incredible amount of self-pity, right? And what self-pity allowed me to do was have license. So because none of this was true, I could do anything I wanted. Now, at this time, I'm already married because I figured that would fix me, and it didn't, right? So I start doing whatever I want. I'm living the double life. I'm living at the top of my life and what I'm showing to everybody. You know, I'm trying to dance the dance, but deep down, you know, I'm just following deeper and deeper into these, you know, into all sorts of things. Because what happened is the problem with a lie that's told to me like that is that once I start believing that lie, is that then I'm separated from the truth inside of me, and I'm not able to love because it's all this separation. Again, it's always an opportunity for me to be separated. And so once that when that there's no love, like if I'm separated from the truth inside of me and I'm not loving, you know, people, I'm not connecting to people. In fact, I can't love, right? Because I have to be separate in order to do the stuff that I want to do, in order to get away with what I want to do. And then what, if I start doing this, I start becoming even more disconnected. And over time, you know, it just doesn't, in the end, it just becomes the sort of thing where I've got this situation where I can't possibly get myself out of. I've done this little trick of, you know, the trap that I can't get myself out of. And, you know, there are certain things that happen that I thought I might see my way out of it. And, you know, by this time I'm drinking all the time, I got a job in an office where I can close the door and I can drink. I find the people at work that I drink with. I'm just, you know, this is the way that I figure life is going to be, and it's getting smaller and smaller. I'm making more and more concessions. And, you know, I figure God, I can't find God, right? I'm not looking for God anymore, and that's, you know, the reason why I can't find him. But that's, you know, he's not showing himself to me, so obviously he doesn't exist. And things happen that show me that God's, you know, alive in my life. And for instance, one of them was the birth of my daughter. And I was blown away by this amazing experience. And I thought, you know, wow, I can, you know, I'm no longer a predator. I'm now going to be a protector of this little baby. Like, and I thought that that was going to change me. But she was born on St. Patrick's Day. So I said I wasn't going to drink, but, you know, it's St. Patrick's Day. And, you know, what do? You celebrate, you know, the birth, and pretty soon I'm drunk. And my wife's like, you're not here for me. And I'm like, yeah, well, but, you know, this is how you celebrate. And that's not how she celebrated. And it continued on like this until I went to my, I finally admitted to my doctor that I was drinking a lot because there was liver damage, you know, that showed that I was drinking a lot. I could no longer lie and say, you know, he's like, well, I don't understand. If you're only drinking like a drink or two a week, how come these levels? And I'm like, all right, I'm drinking all the time and I can't stop. And he said, well, why don't you try AA? And a lot of people, there were people in my life that were, I made friends with in AA, and they said, why don't you try the steps? And I had the great good fortune when I came to AA, I met a man who I got along with. I didn't know, I met him through my child's daycare. And he said to me, you know, how do you feel about the idea of God? And I was, when I was looking for God, I was always trying to do it as knowledge. Like, I wanted to read about different spiritual traditions. I wanted to add all this stuff on. You know, I wanted to know it. You know, I wanted to kind of classify it and know it. And once I had it all together, then maybe I could, you know, maybe then I could take a step towards it. But now I had to be all prepared for it, apparently. And this man was completely irreverent, not interested at all in what I knew about, you know, what my ideas were about God or what God was. And in fact, he kind of made fun of some of the ideas that I had. I thought that was kind of rude. You know, he's not interested in what I know. That's very strange, you know, I mean. And, this guy, you know, I knew I was an alcoholic. I didn't know what it really, I knew what my life was unmanageable at that point because I tried to stop drinking. I'd tried to stop drinking, and it always just came back harder when I said, I'm not going to drink. And I made the commitment I would drink earlier in the day. So I knew what it was like. The first step made sense to me, but for all that I thought that I had God in my life and understood God, it wasn't until I took the second step and I said one of the first honest things I'd said in a long time when he said, you know, do you believe in the power greater than yourself? And I said to him, no, I don't. I don't. I've been interested in God my whole life, and all I've been interested in is that it's made me feel better about myself and better than other people. That I have a connection to something, and instead what I was doing was taking that connection, this which was real, and distorting it. But and so I didn't really believe it was larger than myself. I was using it to try to inflate myself, which has been, in saying that to him, it kind of, I never realized that until he asked me that straight question in the second step. And he said, and then he said, do you believe that, you know, I believe in a power greater than myself? And I said, yeah, I definitely believe that. I've heard your story, and I believe it. And he says, do you think that could happen to you? I was like, well, I don't know. I've been around this stuff a long time. It doesn't seem to take anything. But you believe it's possible? Is it possible that could happen? I said, sure. Anything's possible. And from that, we went instantly into the third step prayer. And we said the prayer together, held hands, and in my mind's eye, I'll never forget this, I actually saw a door opening. And I saw this light, and I had this feeling like I'd felt like when I was 5 years old, like this, the simplicity of this thing, that I was actually opening myself up to it. And then I promptly saw a figure closing the door. Do not open that door. Do not look behind door number two. And I shared this with him, and he goes, well, that's good. You know, that's your ego. That's your ego. Your ego's scared right now. You know, he doesn't want it. It doesn't want that light. And this guy I followed, he had about 22 years of sobriety. A lot of you probably know him. His name is Scott Redman. And he, what was interesting to me is that he kept this stuff fresh. He was fiercely attached to becoming closer to this higher power. You know, he said there was, he would always try something, he was always trying something new, reading something new. It was never stale for him. And, using that as a model, and that's how I've heard from, through Scott, I heard about Sandy, who's also the same way, keep on moving, toward the higher power, toward this connection. And we talked a lot about separation, and I came to understand, or I came to experience that the separation is a complete lie, and he directed me to, because I shared with him what I shared with you, and he led me to the Sermon on the Mount, the forgiveness prayer. And in that forgiveness prayer, it describes, there's two places that describe like this uncivilized alcoholic mind really well. There's many places, but the two that I think of is like page 62, you know, selfishness, self-centeredness, you know, that is the root of our problems. And then in, even though alcoholism is not mentioned in the part of the Lord's Prayer written by Emmett Fox, he describes the law of the jungle, that we think that we're allowed, we can live separate from other people because that allows us to take what we need to take and take advantage of other people before they take it from us. And that's a lie. And that broke me open. And I saw that is a lie. And I'd been telling myself a lie for a long time, and I'd been saying it just so I could help myself to whatever I didn't want to work for any of this stuff. I wanted it automatically, and if I wasn't going to get it, I'd take it anywhere I can. And that really redirected my connection there. I knew that connection was powerful. And so for the first time, and experienced it tonight too, from then until now, I've experienced the fact that there is people that have suffered and have the same kind of strange mental twist that I have, this kind of suffer from the selfishness and self-centeredness, and that they're willing to spend their lives to get closer to their higher power, so they don't have to live like that anymore. Because the pain and the lack of power, the pain from having that kind of lack of power, is unbearable. And the thing that there's this kind of separation is interesting though, because it's hard for me. Even though the first thing I have to stop doing is stop playing God, I find that even after time, I still find ways to work in ways of playing God. And if it's really helpful. Working with sponsor has been really helpful. Working with sponsees has been even more helpful, you know, in that regard of trying to, you know, really trying to allow people the dignity of their own experience and not trying to control, you know, what they're experiencing or tell them what they're experiencing. One other thing that's happened too is that I have a tendency to become awake. Like I'll have these realizations, and then I'll slowly like drift off, fall asleep again, you know. And that's why it's important for me to keep on coming to a place like this and keep on reading and try to keep that stuff awake, because, you know, I have a tendency to old ideas. I've got it figured out. Things are working well, and I've got it figured out. I have no idea. I mean, my idea of God has completely changed, and it changes all the time. And the problem is that I'm desperate. I forget that this more is going to be revealed, right? That it's the revelation. I have the revelation, and then I try to classify it and label it and try to figure it out in a ritual and make a technique so I can continue to experience it in the way that I had experienced it, as opposed to keeping it alive and new all the time. And a lot of we were talking a lot about old ideas so far this weekend, and a lot of the ideas meditation has allowed me to see a lot of these ideas about that I have about myself and about other people and about, and I don't even know where these ideas come from a lot of the time. I've spent so much time believing in them, but they're not even, I hear like a kid I grew up with, that idea came from my brother, or that idea, that was never my idea. It's just something that I've taken in and kind of said, oh, that works, and all of it, I find myself repeating it, and why do I believe that? The duality thing is fascinating, you know, this kind of separation. You know, the joke is, you know, the opposite of duality is duality. But the problem that happens is that why can't I? So I start asking myself questions in my meditation and in contemplation. You know, why do I have this complete unconditional love for my daughter, but why am I restricting that from other people? Is it because it's my daughter? Is my the key thing there? Why can't, I know that we're connected, why do I constantly have these things where I'm, oh, well, this is a little better than that, and I'm going to put this over here, and, you know, I'm going to put this on a pedestal. And, you know, why do I constantly search, you know, I find myself doing that almost reflexively, and it's kind of, it's kind of entertaining. I mean, I can see this stuff happening, it's really, for a while, it really bothered me that I know I've had this experience of what it's like, you know, to be connected, and yet why don't I do that all the time? And then I would turn that around to beat myself up. Well, you really shouldn't, you know, you know better than that. You're not doing this right. You know, and then I would turn that all into about myself again, you know, that I'm the problem, you know, that I can't just, you know, laugh at it, you know, that this is, you know, I'm not supposed to be able to figure this all out. I can't. My mind is not, I can't possibly conceive of it. I can only experience it. You know, it was first important for me to allow other people, my sponsees, the dignity of their own experience. But then, you know, it's important to allow myself the dignity of my experience too, to kind of have, you know, to kind of trust in the experience of, and, you know, I constantly remind myself every morning I can't play God and trust in God at the same time, you know. And I'm trying to look at more and more ways of just like of trying to let go, and let God, you know, into my heart, as opposed to trying to figure out how it works, instead of just going with what I've experienced and sharing it with other people. It's funny, the ego. One thing that I was really for a long time, I really thought my ego was my problem, and I've come through listening to people such as Sandy. I really think of it, you know, the ego is just another storyteller. It was something that was real helpful, because I thought, if God is everything, then how does that explain my ego? Isn't my ego part of God? Well, you know, the ego is just another storyteller. And I read this thing recently about immunology. They were talking about how there's higher incidence of allergies now. And they're trying to explain why, you know, there's people are more and more allergic to things more than they ever have been, you know, the whole peanut allergy. And scientists did this experiment down in Venezuela, and they did a comparison of people that had, who were wealthy and had a great standard of living, and they compared them all, then they compared the middle group, who was working class, and then the last group down in Venezuela, there were Indians. And they did a measure of parasites to allergies, and the Indians had no allergies, and they had 100% parasites. For instance, they were full of parasites, and then the middle group was like this, and then the wealthy people, they had almost no parasites, but they had all of this, you know, they had all these allergies. And when I read that, I thought, well, that's interesting, because I think that I think that the ego is sort of what came about from our need for our sense of survival. Like, there was a time where we had to, you know, motivate ourselves to, like, you know, to get what we needed out of nature when things were, you know, a lot tougher. And in a, you know, relatively short amount of time, our culture has become to the point where we've been provided so much that I think the ego has a lot of time to basically, you know, start seeing where it can cause problems. I think it's, you know, where it can say, you know, well, wait a minute, you know, instead of saying I need to do this to survive, it's like that person looked at you the wrong way. And then that suddenly for me becomes like a survival thing, you know. So I think of that, like, as we've had more in my sobriety, the more and more I one thing I want to be conscious of, the more benefits and blessings that I've got from, I don't want to be spoiled by those blessings. I want to make sure that my ego is, I want to be aware of the fact that the ego is going to come in and, you know, distort some of this, you know, connection that I have with God, that the ego is going to come in and generate a lot of problems that aren't there. That in fact I have everything that I need now, and I need to let go, and I need to keep working with other guys, and I need to keep asking for help over and over again, because my first experience is, as described earlier, with God, is that they were just basically distortions of my ego, and I was trying to do it all on my own. And there's nothing like being with a group of men that are trying to do this, trying to continually ask for help, trying to continually get closer to God, and to share this experience that they've had, to share this good news with other people. And I'm just tickled pink to be able to be part of this, and I never, you know, the 2 years ago when I first came here, I've just changed so much just in that short period of time, mostly because of this, the ability to come here and listen and, you know, listen and really try to bring, keep my heart open, as opposed to try to figure it out, just to kind of try to enjoy the experience. So thank you very much.
You made it, Jim. Thank you so much. And Jim reminded me of something. I want to share a spiritual moment before I call on our second gentleman. You mentioned hospice again. And this moment occurred a few years ago when our friend Keith Lewis passed away. Keith was a circuit speaker and a great sharer, and I sponsored him up in D.C. He was an ex-Marine. And he was in hospice up in Ocala, and several of us would go up there on a regular basis. So it was getting down to the very, very end. And I was there to witness the hospice people. I have so much respect for them. And what I witnessed was the hospice people turning Keith over and changing the linen. Now, that doesn't sound like a big deal. But you should have seen the respect that they had. They had practiced this, where two of them would lift, the other two slid out the old. It had been practiced so many times that it looked like a ritual. And then he was turned with all new linen, and then they gracefully departed. And the thought came into my mind that I've seen something like that before at Marine Corps funeral services, when the Marines in their dress blues take the flag off the coffin, they fold it, it ends up in a perfect triangle, and with great respect they go over and give it to the widow. And it came back, and I just want to tell hospice how wonderful they are. Okay, now we're going to get to our second gentleman, who I've known for many, many years. And he lives, a lot of you that don't know Florida, he lives in Mount Dora, Florida. You didn't know that Florida had a mountainous area. You think of it as a flat state. But George lives in Mount Dora, and I went up to visit, and I came home with a bumper sticker that said, "I climbed Mount Dora." And due to erosion, Mount Dora isn't as high as it used to be. It used to be 352 feet, and it's now only 351. Let's welcome my dear friend George. Come on up.
Hi, everyone. I'm George Dunn from Mount Dora, Florida. Mount Dora was billed as the highest place in the state, and consequently all the zanies who are anticipating the end of days are nearby so that they can, you know, be on the top when the big wave comes in. So it is, despite the sound of its name, it's an interesting spot to live. And I followed Sandy to Florida about a year after he moved down, and I got sober in D.C. And I was one of those that when I finally got a year, they paraded me around to speak all over the place. And I, of course, realized that they had noticed something truly exceptional in me. And down the road, I overheard somebody say, yeah, if that idiot can get some... That was a little spiritual awakening, or experience right there. But I was one of those, I really met Sandy well the first time he helped me the most, which was on my way to the State Mental Institution in Virginia. I had shorn off the whole passenger side of my car and screaming maniacally in a meeting. I was really out of my mind. I was a little nervous, and I tried to get to this meeting because I knew the safety and love was there. And I used drugs alcoholically, but alcohol was the love of my life. The drugs I used primarily, and I'll just mention this and stop, the drugs I used allowed me to stay drunker than a skunk for 4 days in a row without sleep, or to hopefully parachute to safety after one of these drunks. But so I was a tried and true alcoholic, and I believe that I was out of control from the very first drink. My life revolved around it. My decisions revolved around it. I wound up in the saloon business. Made perfect sense. Thrown out of college couple times in the saloon business. Owned a saloon where the worse you got, the better people liked you, which was a good environment for an alcoholic. We had one guy, Rudy the Pig, who was always worse than everyone. And so as long as Rudy was out there, we were all good. My day came, however, and I became that one. I've somehow lost touch with reality. I had no God in my life. I'd been sent away to a religious Catholic denominational boarding school where I had a very freaky experience with my priest faculty advisor, and at age 12, it just gave me the creeps really bad and soured me greatly toward religion and God. And as my drunken behavior continued, my separation from God and from everything good became greater. I had to abandon any sense of morality or any values or beliefs that I had earlier had, because I needed new ones to explain my behaviors, you know, and I moved further and further away. I got to the point where I was doing Gothic print like the monks did of F God, you know, trying to make a statement like that, but that's where I was with God. And when the option to come to AA, I got intervened upon through a series of drunk drivings, and was sent to AA and reported back that, well, I don't believe in God, you know, so I can't, you know, it's not for me. And the reality was that I was terrified that there might be a God. And what would happen if he ever got his hands on me? So I didn't make it right away. It took a series of in and outs at the local nut ward, where I finally was banned. if you set fire to the nut ward, they want you out of there. So, but the state mental institution decided that they wanted me around for a while, and they called Mom with me sitting there, and this woman at the mental hospital told her she had to come up to Virginia and sign the papers that I had to spend the rest of my life there. And I'd had a little bit of AA via the drunk driving requirements. I begged my mom to get me out of there, and she did. And I turned to AA. This time I'd been through a 6-week phase of being chased by demons. The devil was trying to possess me, and that's where Sandy was at that meeting when the devil, I guess, almost caught me that night. My first night in there was in isolated confinement. And they moved me into general population where I wanted to tear my eyes out of my head. And so they moved me into general population. First night there's a knife fight in the main hall where I am. And and the next morning they called my mom. So it's the most scariest time I've ever had in my life. And I knew that I had to have God. I had to have God. I had to change no matter what happened. And I realized that I would do anything. I burned rug burns onto my knees for the first 2 months. I just kept throwing myself on the floor. I who didn't believe. And I think the first sign for me of a spiritual experience, I had gotten this great sponsor up there that was in my neighborhood, would be at the meetings every night that I was going to, a man named Buck Doyle. And Sandy, of course, knows him. And I finally confided. Buck had visited me at the mental institution. He knew. But I finally revealed this terror. I said, "Buck, I think I'm crazy. I thought there was no hope." He said, "Hell, we're all crazy. It's just when we drink, we get caught." You know? My early spiritual experiences came in the form of being gently, piece by piece, restored to sanity. You know, it was amazing. Every meeting I went to, I was like a loose jigsaw puzzle in a box, and people were, pieces were a piece here, a piece there, and I was on the lookout for God. At this point, I had a white lightning experience at home. I had one of those. I think God knows I probably needed one. I'm one of the hard-headed variety, and. But anyhow, I had this consciousness of God throughout my early sobriety. And it came and being lovingly restored to sin. And it came again when I did the third step just because, boy, I got no better option. I better do this fast, I got on my knees and did it. But in the fourth step, you all were talking about a God of our understanding. I thought, boy, I hope he's forgiving. I really need a forgiving God here. And in this fourth step, this God was there with me writing it and forgave me and understood me. And I knew this. I sensed it. Again, in the amends steps, amazing things happened there. And things were happening along the way. I know that there were so many times I should have been dead before I got sober that God was dragging me through the sand. We all know footprints. And I couldn't be open to see it then. It was either great luck or else I'd been yet again a victim of circumstance was my idea of a godless world. But now, in the program, I'm seeing God and looking for God, but I don't trust Him beyond my sobriety. You know, I want the right of decision in women, jobs, what I do other than stay, you know, go to meetings and all. If that makes any sense. I was just, my God, you know, I'm help me stay sober today. And by sober, I meant help me not drink. It's amazing that they talk about how the door can be opened a little more and a little more. And I love, Jim, how you were talking about staying open and, you know, letting it open. And I came to this retreat for the first one, and I've come ever since. It's been the most profoundly positive influence in my sobriety and in me since I got sober. I had reached the point that letter speaks to of the mission of this retreat. It's for those men who have been sober a good while and kind of feel like I've come this far and this may be it. And I was ripe when I got here. I'd been in a marriage for 20 years in the program, and my wife was in the program, and she'd been on drugs for the last 12 years, and I was dying inside, and just dying inside. First time I was here, the book that came into my hand was Chuck C's Pair of Glasses. And I got a clarification there. He even went further than Bill Wilson. He said, God either is or he isn't. And if he is, he's everything. And if he's everything, he's more than substantial to all my needs. And I knew at that moment that this, I needed to enlarge my God. That's all it was. My limitations were my own. I couldn't possibly conceive of a God. But yet, as I sought God in each area of this, what I was going through, and I ultimately filed for divorce after having done everything possible. And, you know, which even included looking at myself, you know. But, you know, and realized that I had been playing God in this relationship. I'd tried 1,000 times in 100 different ways to get through to her, and I was breaking down physically and emotionally and spiritually, and had been. And we went off, we did every type of counseling, everything, so that when it was finally done, I had absolute clarity, and I was able, through this program, to treat her with respect and love and dignity. You know, not my style, said Casey, but it was the program gave me this, a new way of looking at things, a new way of doing things. I think I'll give you a quick example of a spiritual experience I got. I believe God mostly works through other people. After the divorce, my first engagement was sort of a blast from the past, in that it was the old type of thing where I got quickly, immensely, deeply involved with a crazy Asian she-devil. It was very exciting, you know. And I'm talking to a friend of mine, and I'm like, whoa, this is, you know, beyond a bad jackpot. And God spoke through him to me and said, if you'll remember when George Washington gave his farewell address to the country, he admonished us to avoid foreign entanglement. And I was, thank you, God, you know. I can hear these now. I see them as from God. I had a wonderful spiritual experience when the nut ward that I was banned from, the head psychiatrist there continued to work with me for a while. And I said to him, what about AA? It works. And he said, not for you. And scared me because, I didn't see much in the way of chances. But I reeled out of his office and a church across the street beckoned me in where there was a minister just happened to be right there who was willing to talk to me. And he convinced me to put all my eggs in the AA basket. And so off I went. But after I'm sober 3 years, I'm respectable. I've got a good job. I have a good title. I'm wearing a suit. And as a favor, I was asked to close a contract on a good real estate deal, even though I wasn't dealing in that area, but it was for a friend. And as the group of sellers came in after the negotiations were complete, I recognized this gentleman, didn't know quite from where, just that we knew each other, that feeling. And he looked at me in the same way. And at the end of him being the final signer of the contract, I realized this is the head psychiatrist from the nut ward. And right below that, I've already signed my name. And the look on his face, I think he thought I was impersonating, but I waited the next day till 10 minutes of the hour and called him, and he took the call immediately. And we talked about how AA works miracles in people's lives. So I wonder, was that whole run at that nut ward so that God could tell him AA works miracles in people's lives? It is a new pair of glasses, isn't it? He was right. I don't know. I was given the amazing opportunity this year to work with a man coming in almost as crazy as I had come in. He was, in addition, a PhD, an MD, a university professor, everything but a lawyer, in terms of degree of difficulty. And this man got a year, and I got to learn love and patience and tolerance as Buck and Sandy did with me. Probably, I don't know, how that happens, but I just felt a big full circle with that. It was when he got a year, everybody came up and congratulated me. But this retreat has brought so much vitality into my AA. My God, my connectedness with the groups and with men especially, and a real renewed love of the program and a much deeper love of my God. When we play Amazing Grace out here, and I think of the second line, that saved a wretch like me, and a lot of people object to having to refer to themselves as wretches, but I have no problem with that. And I get goosebumps every time I hear it. I know that the tapes from this retreat have brought it back and given me the opportunity to really hear it almost for the first time. And I listen to them over the years and spread them out to everybody I can. And great thing is with the spirit of rotation is that I'll still be able to get tapes and be here in spirit and think of you all next year. And it's wonderful. Sandy, thank you. Thank you. Love you. Bye.
That was two wonderful sharings, and I really appreciate it. And I just have to tell you my side of George and Buck Doyle. Do you mind, George? I'll be right with you. Buck was Mr. AA in Northern Virginia. He was the man. So Saturday night was his big meeting, so I was there. And he saw me, and he goes like this. I mean, and you run right over. And he said, "Sandy, George is coming. I think he's really messed up tonight. So you stand at the door, and when he comes in, you stay with him." So I had my marching orders for the night. So I'm standing there, and here comes George. And I did notice that his eyeballs were enormous. And I went, "George, yeah, come on. And he's going, they're after me. And I'm going, "Who? This crazy woman, they're trying to drive me crazy. I was coming down Shirley Highway and they're chasing me. I think we bumped their car." And we came out and I said, "You think you bumped their car? Well, let's go look at your car." And went out, there's a door missing. And I go, "Yeah, you did bump there, George." And so we went back in and I sat next to him. And it kind of went through the whole meeting. And then after the meeting, Buck is trying to find somebody that George can stay with that night. And I think Buck had something arranged the next day, but Buck was tied up and couldn't do it. And he's calling in people he sponsors. And he's going, "Jerry, come here. I need you to have George." And they'd look at George and they go, "Well, I'm going to be out of town, Buck. I won't be able to." And everybody said no. Finally, Buck got this guy who was kind of a meat guy, probably about 50 years old. He seemed old to me then. And he had an older girlfriend and the two of them were standing there. And Buck has really got him by the tie. And he's going, "Look, I got to get to him, you know, I helped you." And then so finally the guy goes, "All right, okay." And he goes, "George, come here. This is Frank, and he's going to take care of you tonight. And this is his girlfriend, Alice. Alice must have looked like the woman was chasing George down Shirley Highway." And he went right for her throat. And the thing I remember the most was the guy looked at Buck and said, "I don't think so, Buck."